Hi, I'm Mark Brody, and this is the Friday Newscap Podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
I certainly can't imagine us not asking. Arizonans paid nearly $200 million for the putting up that container wall and then taking it down and storing, and I think we deserve some of those funds back.
I believe these are auxiliary to this, and I don't believe there's a direct conflict on this, and so I think we have a great shot at winning these.
But I treat people fairly. I treat people respectfully. I'm not mad at them when they engage in misconduct. We just hold them accountable.
This is especially important for law enforcement to be able to ensure that they're able to step in when necessary to be able to seize pets when needed, as well as for the Arizona Humane Society to ensure that pet owners have appropriate education.
We are arguing that the secretary, who's a totally unelected executive agent, is using legislative power to pick and choose which laws she wants to disregard with respect to border wall construction.
These are two of the businesses that most persistently and recklessly sell tobacco, nicotine products, to underage kids in Arizona.
And with me to talk about a new arrangement to fund Democratic campaigns in Arizona, an Arizona senator heading to the Iowa State Fair, and more, our former state school superintendent Jaime Molera of the firm Molera Alvarez. Good morning, Jaime.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
And former congressional staffer and attorney Roy Herrera. Roy, good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to both of you. So, Roy, let me start with you talking about the Copper State victory. This is an arrangement that is funneling money and resources through the Navajo County Democratic Party in response to, I think, a lot of state Democrats have concerns about the state of the state party. How well or not well do you expect this to work?
I think it's going to work very well. I mean, so this is going to be the coordinated campaign for all of the Democrats. And I think the Democrats know how important next year is with all three Democratic statewide officials up for reelection, with a legislature up for grabs, with two competitive congressional districts. And it's very necessary to have a robust and sophisticated and well-funded coordinated campaign. That's one of the sort of essential things. And this, Copper State victory infrastructure is going to ensure that that occurs. Now, will this infrastructure work with the state Democratic Party? I'm sure it will in some aspects. You know, obviously there's a lot of issues going on over there with the state party and the chairman. And, obviously the state committee is going to probably have a say on his future going forward. But either way, this coordinated campaign is going to ensure that the Democrats have what they need to win next year.
In a perfect world, like, is this the kind of thing that Democrats would like to have avoided if they could have?
Well, I mean, there's always something that could be better, right, with political campaigns, certainly. I mean, we have seen this approach before in Arizona on the Republican side. We've seen Senator McCain do that when he was up for reelection. We've seen Governor Ducey do this, a similar thing when he was up for reelection. So, and those campaigns worked. They got reelected. Generally speaking, the Republicans did well those cycles. So I don't think it's going to be any different for the Democrats this time and for Governor Hobbs and Fontes and Mays.
So, Jaime, Roy mentioned the Republican Party doing this, most notably through the Yuma County Republican Party. It was not a permanent thing. I mean, the state Republican Party seems to have, they have a new chair now, and, they seem to be able to handle what they need to be doing. What to you does this say sort of about the state of the Arizona Democratic Party?
Well, I was going to say, I haven't seen this kind of chaos and dysfunction since the Republican Party 4 years ago.
It's like a pendulum, just back and forth.
That's right. As Roy said, these are the kinds of things that tend to happen, but the leadership is going to want to make sure that they control the dollars in a way that they think is most effective. And certainly the state party right now, I think there's no confidence that they're able to do that, just like there was with the Republicans. But the thing that I found amusing when they announced they're going to be going through the Navajo County Democrat Party, it was all this laudatory talk about how, they're so organized and that county has that infrastructure that we can use. They're not going to make one decision. I want $1 get spent. It's going to be the Democratic operatives that are controlled by the state leadership on how they're going to drive that money. They're just using it as a conduit so that they can park their money and then figure out how to utilize it in the next election cycle.
Do you see, other than sort of the mechanism for doing this, I guess maybe sort of in the background, in the philosophy, do you see parallels between when the Republican Party did something similar to this?
Oh, of course. Very similar, because it was the exact same thing. When Kelly Ward was the chairman, and it was very acrimonious, and they had a lot of dysfunction, and they couldn't raise money. So the leadership said, you know what, we're just going to do it our own. Governor Ducey basically had their own organization, but they controlled it. And so that's the key of this thing, is that who controls the dollars and how do they want it expended? And also, one of the other big things is, what races will they consider to be the ones that they want to put their money into?
Mm.
So that's going to be interesting. But again, that's where whoever has the dollars tends to control how it gets spent.
Roy, is this the kind of thing that in a perfect world, and we've heard from the Navajo County Democratic Party chair saying, look, we're going to do this now by 2028 when it's a presidential year. Ideally, the state party is better able to handle that kind of thing. In a perfect world for Democrats, is this a temporary arrangement?
It might be. And, you know, Jaime, it's funny. You don't believe something you saw in a press release? I guess not. But no, I agree with a lot of what Jaime said. I mean, a lot of this is going to be about, you know, making sure, again, that the fundraising is done correctly. You know, the funds are coming in, and again, that they're being spent correctly. And when you have, you know, Senator Kelly, Senator Gallego, Governor Hobbs, you know, three people who have won very tough elections in a very tough state for Democrats, mm-hmm. you know, as a Democrat, I would say, okay, it is them and their operations and their consultants that probably know best when it comes to like how this money should be spent and how we should go forward to put Democrats in the best position to win next year. So, you know, I think, you know, whether it's this time through Copper State, whether in 2028 it's through the state Democratic Party, either way, I think I feel confident that the people that are going to make the decisions, strategic decisions, and do the fundraising are going to be people that have won, have a track record of winning, and will win again.
You know, it's interesting,
yeah, though,
this is the one thing that I've seen that has brought Governor Hobbs, Secretary Fuentes, and Attorney General Mays together. Boy, they look like a team. They look like a happy team, like a happy family, which you never really see very often.
It's like sort of the common enemy thing, right?
Right.
You need that can bring people together. Roy, let me stick with you on CD7. This is the special election coming up on Tuesday to replace the late Congressman Raul Grijalva. It seems as though on the Democratic side, and this is a pretty heavily Democratic district, I mean, the conventional wisdom is that whoever wins the Democratic primary will most likely win this seat. It seems like at this point it's a three-person race between Adelita Grijalva, Congressman Grijalva's daughter, former state lawmaker Daniel Hernandez, and Deja Fox. Is that sort of what you're hearing as well?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's the field, right? I mean, there's some other candidates, but they're not major candidates. I think the conventional wisdom right now from the people that I talk to is that Adelita is the clear favorite to win next week. I think what's maybe surprising right now to a lot of people is when people are sort of predicting who's going to finish second, a lot of folks now are saying it's going to be Deja Fox, which a lot of people wouldn't have said, you know, a month ago or whatever, since she's a brand new candidate. So if we end up, you know, with a race that results in Adelita winning the primary and then Deja Fox second and Daniel Hernandez third, I think that second and third slot is going to be pretty surprising. Because I think Deja Fox, in some sense, you know, and there's been some articles in The Republic about her, from the social
and
media perspective,
too, yeah.
You know, she's gotten some momentum. Ultimately, it's not going to be enough, I think, to beat Adelita. Adelita's going to be the next congresswoman. But it is something, and it's notable, I think.
What does that do, I guess, in for Democratic politics in Southern Arizona? Because Daniel Hernandez he obviously was a state lawmaker himself. Both his sisters are state lawmakers, so that, you know, and they're a pretty well-known political family in Southern Arizona.
Right.
To have, if, as Roy suggests, maybe he comes in third and Deja Fox, who's young and, very strong social media presence, like, what does that do? Does that change the sort of the balance of Democratic political power in Southern Arizona at all?
I don't think so. I think what you're seeing is a trend that's happening within the Democratic Party. I mean, Deja Fox has been compared to AOC and young, very progressive. And that's been a trend of the party. And that's one of the reasons, in my opinion, I think they're having some difficulty, especially in the more competitive areas where those kinds of candidates don't tend to do well. Now, certainly I agree with Roy that the District 7 is going to be a Democrat district. I mean, it's just so heavily, unless something majorly crazy happens. Grijalva should win that election, the reason I think that is that as of right now, about 20% of folks have already voted in the early ballot.
Yeah,
so 20% of that's a pretty good turnout for a special election. So the higher that is, I think the more that indicates that Grijalva and those kinds of machines that tend to know how to get out the vote and they're more sophisticated about that tend to do better. I'm a little surprised that Daniel Hernandez has fallen to a pretty distant third. So because he's raised the most money, he's already raised over $1 million.
Right.
So it's interesting to see how that's going to play out. But it really should be because of Grijalva and her name. And also she has a very strong connection with the progressive wing. I think that's a big help to her.
Obviously, whoever wins this is going to have to run again in the regular election next year. Will there be anything in the results that might be tea leaves to read for 2026?
Well, again, if Deja Fox does better than expected and it's much closer, then that shows that there is that element of the Democratic Party that really likes that and really wants to push that hard progressive policies. And I think that tends to, big picture, tends to bode well better for Republicans, because I think that was one of the key points in 2024, and I think why Republicans did so well. So it'll be interesting to see. But I think the Democrats are understanding that they have to do a better job of reaching out to what was their traditional base, which is the blue-collar workers, union workers, and get back to the economic issues as this, instead of the social policy issues.
Roy, let me ask you about somebody for whom you used to work, U.S. Senator Ruben Gallego. He announced this week he'll be going to the Iowa State Fair. I assume he'll be excited to try all the fried food and the corn maze and the butter sculptures and all. But I also assume that's not the reason he's going.
He's going for the fried PB&J, I'm sure.
As one would.
As one would. You know, I think, you know, obviously, Senator Gallego is a unique voice, a prominent voice. I think one of the, you know, the sort of biggest leaders now of the National Democratic Party, as well as obviously Arizona. And I think he's going to go to Iowa and share his perspective, both as someone who won an incredibly difficult Senate race in a difficult state, but also to talk about some of the things, you know, coming from a working class background, a military background, the kind of messaging, I think, that is going to be very useful and effective for Democrats going forward. I mean, we just talked about in the prior segment about, you know, depending on where you're running, you have to change your message. You know, obviously a message in a deep, you know, blue district might be different than what you do nationally or statewide. And I think he's demonstrated the ability to do kind of it all. And so I think that that's what he's going to do in Iowa. And I also think, I mean, obviously we're going to maybe talk about the big, beautiful bill, but like he's going to be there to talk about the devastating effects of that from his perspective on people nationally and, of course, in Arizona.
Jaime, is it fair to assume that this trip will also continue the talk and the prognostication about whether or not Senator Gallego might be looking to run for president in a few years?
Well, I always remember there's an old saying that when somebody becomes a United States senator, when they wake up in the morning, they look in the mirror, they see the presidential seal looking back at them. So, but I think that Senator Gallego and the way he ran his campaign in Arizona really should be a model, and Republicans should be worried about those kinds of candidates. I just don't see that happening right now. I think the Democratic Party, as I talked about earlier, has been going more and more to the progressive wing. However, if he's able to come across as that person that can articulate why they need to talk about the working class and talk about things that people really care about, as opposed to, again, those kinds of social issues that tend to dominate the Democratic discussions, then he could be a formidable candidate. That's for sure.
Is this the kind of thing where, Jaime, as you alluded to, and Roy, you talked about it too, sort of getting this message out where even if he's, I mean, he has not said, I'm definitely not running for president, but even if that's not front of mind, and I am very loath to get into other people's minds, but is there some part of this, Jaime, that is just about getting that vision for the Democratic Party out, taking presidential politics out of it?
Well, it's good for Senator Gallego just to get that national reputation. His gravitas is expanding. And, you know, he was always considered to be kind of a bombastic congressman. But since he's run his campaign and become a U.S. senator, his credibility amongst even Republicans has grown significantly because they've seen a much more mature, much more disciplined type of candidate, but also now United States senator. So if he continues in that mold, then, yeah, I think he could not just help himself, but really help the Democratic Party here in Arizona, because I think having that kind of a base and that kind of structure can help a lot of other candidates down the ticket.
I mean, is that something, Roy, that is on the senator's mind, do you think, in terms of having his vision of the Democratic Party maybe be the one that wins out or is featured maybe more prominently at the end of the day than any of the other sort of competing visions of what the Democratic Party can be?
Well, I think it's less so about, you know, having his vision win out. I think it's more, you know, sharing what he has been able to accomplish and the lessons to be learned from that. And I think that, you know, ultimately, you know, if it results in more Democrats winning, I think that's a good thing, I think, from his perspective nationally and in Arizona, because we get better policies that way. And so I think he's going to go out and sort of share that vision in Iowa and other places. I mean, we're many political lifetimes away from 2028, so yes. Who knows? There'll obviously be a lot of candidates interested. But in the meanwhile, I think the senator is going to go out there and again, share his perspective, which is exactly the kind of perspective I think the Democrats need right now. And again, when we're talking about the Big Beautiful Bill, where, you know, there's devastating impacts to, you know, Medicaid recipients and rural hospitals and, you know, clean energy, you know, I mean, you can go on and on about the different things in ways that this bill is going to devastate working class people. He's going to be able to attack that and articulate why that's bad and why there's a different way.
I mean, let me ask you about the so-called Big Beautiful mm-hmm. Bill. Governor Hobbs just yesterday announced that she will be asking for some federal money from that, from the border security, border barrier component of that to repay the state for the cost of putting up and then taking down the so-called shipping container border wall that happened under Governor Doug Ducey. Should the governor be holding her breath on getting that big check from the government?
Yes. Well, and people forget, too, it was the reason why we expended about $200 million and then had to take it down was because of the Biden administration. Biden administration sued and said, no, this is actually federal land where you put those containers on, and so you can't do that. And so forcing then Governor Ducey to take it down. So my question is, well, why wouldn't the governor say, well, reimburse us because of the mistakes that Joe Biden did? We should have just kept it there.
That might be a more compelling argument for the Trump administration, don't you think?
Yeah, you might get the money then.
I mean, is it to some extent, this kind of reminds me in some ways of when former Governor Janet Napolitano would make a big deal about requesting the government to pay the state back for the cost of housing or incarcerating people who are not in this country legally, asking the federal government for money dealing with border security, dealing with immigration. The state, as far as I know, didn't get any money then for those things. Safe to say the state's probably not going to get money for this now?
I mean, it's hard to say. This administration is sort of impossible to predict, but I think she's just doing right by Arizonans. I mean, I think if there's an opportunity to potentially get some money back, some taxpayer dollars back, why not try? I mean, I think the prior, you know, shipping container wall obviously didn't work. I mean, I thought it was a mistake at the time. I think she did, too. And now that that's gone and it was sort of, you know, a waste, it didn't really accomplish anything. Again, if you can get some of the money back, then why not try to do that? And instead, you know, use that kind of money for things that actually work when it comes to border security.
Speaking of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, and you mentioned Medicaid and SNAP, the food stamp program, and some others, how prominently do you think those issues will feature in campaign ads, mailers, campaigns in general for Democrats coming up in 2026?
It'll be a huge issue because when we talk about Medicaid, you know, some of the things the bill does when it's going to result in people losing their health insurance, it's going to result in rural hospitals either closing or significantly changing their services, SNAP, et cetera. All of those things are going to be devastating specific to Arizona. I mean, we're talking about, you know, perhaps over 200,000 people that could lose their Medicaid benefits through access as a result of this bill. And that's before, again, we get into some of the other stuff, like the fact that the bill, you know, is devastating to the deficit, for example, which is something that I think like an Andy Biggs is going to have to answer for, as somebody who says he's a deficit hawk but voted for this thing. So I think it's going to be maybe, you know, the number one issue next year when Democrats are trying to attack Republicans over what they voted for.
Jaime, does this put Republicans more on the defensive? Are there ways that they can go on the offensive about the provisions of this
absolutely.
Bill?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that's discounted is the making the 2017 tax cuts permanent.
Yeah.
And I think from a lot of business perspective, a lot of economists' perspective, that they feel that that's very much needed and helpful to our long-term economic growth as a country. But then some of the other things that I'm not so sure it will have that staying power that the electorate will say those are necessarily bad, particularly, for instance, adding what I consider to be reasonable-ish work requirements for people that are able-bodied to say, look, 20 hours a week, you have to have some kind of employment or some kind of job training or some kind of educational programs or volunteer work. I mean, I think there's ways that the American public would say, you know what, there's reasonableness to that. Like if you're taking these kinds of services, then there's an expectation that, yeah, there should be some kind of way to pay that back. And as it deals with some of the issues around rural hospitals, which I think is real, the addition of a $50 billion as a fund to help augment and help to support any kind of problems rural hospitals will have, I could see that growing. Come next year, in election year, if that becomes a bigger problem than that was anticipated, I think you'll have enough Republicans to say, yeah, that is a big issue for us. So I think if you can deal with those kinds of things, and I think there's definitely time to do that prior to the next election cycle, which is 18 months away, there definitely are ways for the Republicans to mitigate some of the things that they're going to get attacked on.
The time issue is interesting because as you were describing those things, the word that kept coming to my mind is nuance. Like those are kind of nuanced arguments. And as we all know, nuance in political campaigns are not usually a good combination.
That's very true. Especially with the Trump administration, too. They're not very nuanced. They just kind of hit on. Yeah.
Do you buy into what Jaime's selling here in terms of being able to be? I think I know the answer to this, but do you think Democrats will have to answer for some of those, like the idea of, you know, if you're taking this federal money, maybe there should be some strings attached kind of thing?
I buy a lot of what Jaime usually sells, but not any of that. No, I mean, that is going to be a difficult explanation. And, you know, we think about, for example, like the reference to the Rural Hospital Stabilization Fund that's in there. Well, it's in there because another part of the very same bill eliminates the Medicaid expansion subsidies from Obamacare, and that's why these rural hospitals are going to have these problems. So it's sort of funny to me and ironic to me where you have one section of the bill that's devastating to rural hospitals and then a smaller fund to try to like make up for that. And I look at that and I say, well, why are we doing any of it? I mean, what's the point of doing that? Similarly, you know, when it comes to some of the qualifications now that are going to be required under Medicaid, this is cynical, but the bill doesn't actually have those requires go into effect until after 2026, right?
Yeah.
So because they don't want anybody, you know, kicked off the rolls, you know, next year. And I think that's because they know that's exactly what's going to happen. And so Democrats are going to have to do a good job, you know, selling or at least arguing for why this is terrible and making the case. And I do think like it's not going to be that difficult because this bill is just so blatantly awful from my perspective.
Interesting. All right, guys, we'll have to leave it there. Roy Herrera, Jaime Molera, thanks to you both for coming in. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's biggest stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.